Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hey, welcome back. It's another day, and you're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. It's Wednesday. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. We got another great week lined up, Tim. This has been going really fast for us already. Wednesday, halfway through the week.
Yeah.
Hump day!
Well, easy there, Tiger.
Well, I just thought I'd mention it. Jenny Ashford will be joining us in a few moments. The Unseen Hand, a new exploration of poltergeist phenomena. That's what's going on. Jimmy Church is with us tomorrow, Tim. We're going to talk about the conspiracy of theories. What drives people to always look for nefarious schemes behind any kind of weird event, tragic or just bizarre? Everybody wants to find other reasons other than just sometimes bad people do bad things.
Yeah.
We'll talk about what his thoughts are on this. Jimmy is the host of Fade to Black and one of the fill-in hosts with me on Coast to Coast AM. Friday, Varla Ventura joins us, Tim. Fairies, pukas, and changelings, a complete guide to the wild and wicked enchanted realm, real stories of these fantastical creatures, and we've got a really bizarre theater of the mind for you. First one from the enchanted realm, I think. So that's what's going on this week. I'm also hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Saturday night from midnight till 4 a.m. JT Townsend will be my guest for the last 3 hours of the show. We're going to do kind of a true crime night, Tim, in that last 3 hour segment. We're going to talk about Charles Lindbergh and the Lindbergh baby. Wow, way to be topical, Dave.
Yeah,
it's only
right.
About 100 gajillion years later.
Yeah, Dave, what about the Lindbergh baby?
There's a really twisted angle to this story that we're going to review. Something that is new to me, but I guess has been kicking around for a while. You know, everybody thinks of Charles Lindbergh and they kind of think of this aeronautical hero.
Yeah.
This flying ace hero that,
sure,
that did all of these amazing things.
Yep.
There was a very dark side to Charles Lindbergh.
Uh-oh.
We're going to talk about that and then talk about how that may have led to the abduction and subsequent murder of his child. Did Lindbergh have a hand? Did he know more than he was letting on? We'll talk about that on Coast to Coast AM. I'll also be joined by a researcher, investigator, and law enforcement official, Greg Lawson, in the first hour, Tim. We're going to look at paranormal perspectives. We're going to find out how people look at things in the heat of the moment and how that may influence their belief in the paranormal. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me.
Good stuff going?
Yeah.
All right. That's what's on tap. Hey, we want to thank our sponsors for the night. We've got Casper Beds. And remember, if you're in the market for a new bed, any size bed, let me tell you, it is a bed that Tim and I absolutely love and stand by. I'm getting more and better sleep than I've ever gotten before. CasperTrial.com/darkness. And then use the code 50SLEEP to save $50 off the cost of any mattress purchase. Also, True Car, when you're in the market to buy a new or a previously owned vehicle, trust the company we trust, True Car. Go check it out and make a confident buying decision going forward with True Car. That's our sponsors for the night. Jenny Ashford is here, Tim. Poltergeist phenomena, right? That seems like such a large, innocuous title.
Yeah.
Poltergeist. What really is poltergeist? What goes on with it? And, you know, we've been around hauntings.
Mm-hmm.
We've been around what we believe to be residual hauntings.
Mm-hmm.
We've been around what we believe to be intelligent hauntings.
Right.
But poltergeist kind of takes on a realm of its own. right?
Oh, yeah.
And there's weird phenomena. Sometimes residual and interactive hauntings are also concurrent with poltergeist phenomena. Mm-hmm. Our guest Jenny Ashford is here to talk to us. She's written the book, The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena. Jenny, thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Fascinating subject. What brought you to research and interest in the poltergeist phenomena?
Well, interestingly enough, I actually started out as a horror fiction writer. But after I started a relationship with Tom Ross, who was actually a poltergeist focus when he was 13 in 1982. Mm-hmm. And he had told me about what happened to him and his family. And I kind of got interested in it. I'd been interested in poltergeist phenomena, ghosts and stuff, you know, when I was growing up. But I'd kind of lost interest in it. I got, you know, more into skepticism and things of that nature. But, you know, the more he kept telling me about this poltergeist that he had experienced, and, you know, I was like, you know, I think I believe you. And maybe there's like something behind this. And so we wrote a book together about his case, which was called The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. And then after that came out, kind of one thing led to another. And I ended up meeting the parapsychologist, Steve Mara. He's a British parapsychologist. And he's investigated a whole bunch of cases. And I started, you know, I made friends with him and started doing some cases with him. And just kind of, you know, all of the conversations we had about what causes poltergeist, what the difference was between poltergeist and, you know, ghost type hauntings mm-hmm. and things like that. And I just, you know, I wrote two books with him. And then I thought, you know, it's like, I'd really like to do like an old school, like William Roll type of, you know, compilation kind of book, just like every poltergeist case I could find or like the most interesting ones and kind of compile them all in one place, you know, along with maybe some of the parapsychological theories about what causes them and what made them different and things like that. Because I felt like there weren't as many compilation type books strictly focusing on poltergeists as there were like compilations of, say, just of ghost stories.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, poltergeist, can you kind of break it down for us? I mean, I know it's a German word that means knocking or noisy ghost, but it right. seems that it really, I don't know, do you believe that it's actual ghost phenomena? Or do you believe that it's more of a psychokinetic and energetic phenomena that's going on?
I definitely come down way more on the side of psychokinesis. And I definitely do think, I mean, you know, some of the cases I wrote about, there were some pretty ambiguous things that could have been a haunting. But really, the whole theme of the book, then the approach that I took with it was that I'm operating under the assumption, and I think a lot of parapsychologists have the same assumption, that poltergeist activity is distinct from ghost type activity, that it's not really caused by the spirit of a dead person, or it's not caused by any type of like outside entity, but it's caused by some type of energy that's emitting from a living person in the environment. And so, and that's kind of the spirit in which I approach the book. And, you know, it's kind of weird because a lot of the cases that I picked, I think, are not usually considered as poltergeist cases. But I was kind of making the argument that even though some of these looked like they could be hauntings or looked like they could be demon possession, for mm-hmm. example, how maybe poltergeist activity, you know, this energy coming from a living person could manifest as that, if that was what the people expected it, you know, to act like it was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay.
And you know, whether that's really correct or not, but that was kind of the spirit in which I approached the book. And, you know, that kind of guided the cases that I chose to highlight in the book.
Have you had paranormal experiences on your own prior to these books and research?
Yeah, well, I had not. Until after I started writing about the paranormal. Because like I said, prior I was a horror writer, so I had never really experienced anything paranormal. I was kind of interested in it, but I'd never had anything happen to me personally. But after, I believe it was after The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist was my first paranormal nonfiction book. And then I wrote one with Steve Mara called The Rochdale Poltergeist. And as I was working on that one, you know, Tom, who wrote the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist with me, he often, you know, would tell me, he's like, oh, I wish you had seen it, because, you know, I was skeptical and I was like, yeah, I wish I'd seen it too. And I've never seen anything like that. And I'm writing about this stuff and I've never seen it. So I almost kind of feel like maybe that, you know, kicked it off, because it started happening at our house.
Oh, really?
Yeah, shortly after, you know, when I, right after I had finished the Rochdale Poltergeist and was working on promoting it and things like that, it actually, it was minor, you know, compared to, you know, Tom's, you know, initial experiences, but it was enough that I was kind of like, whoa, well, there it is. I've finally seen it. You know, it's, I mean, the first thing that happened was just a remote control just came flying off the table all by itself. And, you know, that happened in front of me, Tom, two friends, and Tom's mother. We were all sitting around the room, and that just suddenly happened. And that was the first time that I'd ever actually seen it. And, you know, subsequently, we had other kind of minor things happen, like things flying off cabinet shelves.
Let me ask you about that, right? I mean, here's an interesting philosophy. They've always said, right, if you're leaning on the wall long enough, right, hundreds, thousands of years, whatever it takes, at some point, the magnetic resonance of the wall and your body should mesh. You should at least fall partway through the wall, right? The whole idea that that energy exists. We know that there's energy around us at all times, and everything consists of energy. Do you think these moments, these manifestations where remote controls or books are thrown, things are done like this, could it be more of an explosion of energy coming forth as opposed to anything quote-unquote paranormal taking place, you know, just an energetic exchange, maybe like, you know, when the templates of Earth, you know, rub against each other, creates an earthquake, which can cause rumbling and energetic shifts. Do you think that that might be happening in the ethereal realm?
Yeah, I do think that's possible. I mean, I definitely think, you know, poltergeist, this type of activity, I think, and even through my researches and stuff, I found that it's actually pretty rare. Mm-hmm. And you actually have to have a pretty, you know, a specific set of circumstances, it seems like, for it to take place. And it usually has to do with an adolescent and going through some type of traumatic, you know, emotional activity or something like that. And it almost has to be maybe in a particular environment. Maybe, you know, it has something to do with them interacting with family members in a particular way. And I definitely do think that there is some kind of, and it's probably something that we don't understand yet. You know, mm-hmm. maybe it's something with, you know, quantum mechanics, who knows. But, you know, I like that you said, you know, leaning against a wall for 100,000 years and, you know, one day you'll fall through. I do think that's like an equivalent of it. It's like, you know, you can have all of these, you know, millions of adolescents going through traumatic experiences in their childhood and things like that, and nothing happens. But every now and then you get one that's in the right place, the right time, with the right people around, right environment, and some kind of synergy just takes place between this person and the environment outside of them, you know, with all these factors, and just kind of explodes in this bizarre, you know, seemingly paranormal event. And, you know, I think that explains why it's so rare, but I definitely do think that there's something, some kind of scientific principle maybe behind it that we don't understand, and maybe we never will. But, you know, that's kind of where I fall down. And I don't necessarily, I do consider it paranormal. I don't consider it supernatural, if that makes sense.
Right. No, I'm with you on that. I get that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though. On one side, you said how rare these things really are.
Yeah.
Okay, but yet you've written three books where you've investigated this. So is it really that rare?
Well, the three first books I wrote were just one case each. And this...
But that's three cases. I mean, right there, there's three cases that one person was able to look into and research. So, you know, that's where it gets kind of intriguing for me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I still do think it's rare because, you know, there are billions of people on Earth and... You know, I don't think it happens because even though, I mean, my latest book, The Unseen Hand, has over 100 cases in it. But those cases span back to the first century, you know, most of them taking place in like, you know, from the 18th century to now. But there were, you know, there were a few back in history. Obviously, you know, there's not as much information on those because, you know, a lot of the records have been lost and whatnot. But, you know, and it kind of spans a lot of different countries. I mean, you know, most since I speak English and the book is written in English, a lot of the cases came from English speaking countries. Most of them are American or British or Australian, for example. But, you know, there were some from India. There were some from Africa. There were some that I found, you know, from other countries. So I say rare in the sense that it's not like it happens once, you know, that it almost never happens. I just think it's rare in the sense that, you know, maybe in a given year, you know, among the 7, 8, 9 billion people on the planet, maybe you'll get like a handful, you know. So I think, it's, you know, probably like a portion of 1% of the population will experience something that's legitimately poltergeist activity.
Let me ask you this, just because I like to give everybody a fair shake on this. One of your books, House of Fire and Whispers, Investigating the Seattle Demon House. Now, is this Keith Linder's home that you did the book on? All right. Because in full disclosure, I worked with the local TV station there. They had asked me through Darkness Radio if I would review some of this footage that had been given to them and tell them what I thought of this case. And it was certainly dramatic. Keith Linder had sent some dramatic footage of things being thrown about, holes in the wall, talked about the dramatic things that were going on in his house, these images that were left on his walls. And they asked me, well, what do you believe? And I said, you know, it's really hard because you're giving me a few pieces of a much larger puzzle. Yes, overall, it looks intriguing and interesting, but there's, you know, nothing's ever caught directly on camera. Everything's off to the side where we don't see if there was somebody that threw it from out of frame. And working as a researcher and location scout for the TV show Ghost Adventures, I talked to them about it, and they decided, well, let's go in and investigate this case. Would you come with us? I said, I'd love to, because this is either going to be off the charts Amityville horror style haunting, or this is going to be one of the biggest frauds in history. Nothing happened for us in that house. We didn't even catch a dust orb during that investigation. However, in our work with them, things seemed off. It seemed rehearsed and strange to us. So there was this underlying current of, was this guy looking to sell a story? Was this guy looking to, you know, become the next Amityville Horror? But we could find nothing that would show any kind of paranormal activity. Now, I understand that paranormal does not work like a circus show. You don't just go in, pay your money, and ghosts come out and start to haunt you and throw things around. But it was just strange that here you've got some guys that are able to get EVP everywhere they go or get some kind of activity. We couldn't get a dust ball to fly in front of the camera. What was your take on the investigation and what was going on in Keith Linder's house?
Yeah, that's funny because, I mean, initially, if I hadn't worked with Steve Mara before, the parapsychologist who came in later and investigated it, and if I hadn't known like his credentials and things like that, I don't know if I would have believed Keith Linder's case at first either. Mm-hmm. But I didn't. I mean, I wrote the book mostly from Steve Mara's point of view. I did put a history in the book of what Keith had reported prior to them getting there.
Right.
You know, but he had 4 years of history, you know, before the British parapsychologist got there. I did go into that, like what Keith Linder said he saw and things like that.
Right.
But mostly I did it from Steve's perspective, like what he saw when he got there, what they measured when they got there, and kind of stuck it with that. Like I said, if he hadn't gone there and recorded what he recorded, and, you know, he sent me footage of all the EVPs and he sent me all the photos he had taken, and, you know, he told me all, but he sent me all his case notes and files and things like that. And, you know, he also was skeptical of maybe some of the larger incidents that Keith had taken, you know, like, you know, the 666 on the wall and, you know, the office being trashed and things like that, because the later parapsychologists, they didn't see any of that either. They said really the EVPs were the main thing. They did catch a few object movements, like a ball that moved, and they saw a camera like turn 180 degrees around by itself and things of that nature. They didn't get any of the real big ticket things that Keith had reported. Now, Keith said that that was because, you know, he had had priests in there, they had done exorcisms and things like that. And he even admitted, oh, well, you know, the bigger events kind of calmed down after that happened, but minor things were still happening. So I'm not sure. I kind of believe that maybe there was some minor poltergeist activity happening there.
We found it strange after the episode aired and we talked about it on our show. Keith even called in and I said, you know, it's strange that nothing of real consequence has been broken. Your big screen TV, which seemed to irritate the ghosts because you're playing loud video games, nothing was ever broken. And it was like within a few days of that, all of a sudden, then his computer laptop was broken. He had his pants nailed to the wall. We thought, what kind of message was the ghost sending that the demon's like, I'm going to really get their attention this time and nailed a pair of jeans to the wall. The strange images, there seem to be Native American images and Christianic images on the wall. And, you know, we laughed and not trying to put Keith down or his experiences, which to him appear to be very real. To us from the outside, it looked just bizarre. I mean, we saw a can of black paint in the garage. It was sitting right in front of where they allowed us to set up our observation table. And there, the items on the wall were done in what appeared to be like almost like a flecking or sponge painting. And again, that just seemed like a really weird way for a demonic or poltergeist energy to make itself known, by using that type of painting technique. I would have thought they would have carved it in the wall or scraped it into the wall, something along those lines. But I was just curious, to somebody who's written a book about it, what did Steve or you find in this research? Were you guys ever to do a scraping of that material on the wall to determine whether it was paint or some other type of material?
I believe that they had mostly, by the time that Steve and Don Phillips, his colleague, had gotten there, most of it, I think all of the paint or whatever it was on the walls had been painted over. Mm. Because evidently Keith said that, well, he didn't like it looking at it and it just kept turning up. So I guess he painted over it. I'm not sure if he painted over it because he really didn't like looking at it, it really disturbed him, or if he didn't want them taking samples of it. He didn't really seem to have a problem with them taking samples of other things.
Right.
Because, you know, when Steve went back the second time, there was some kind of oily substance like coming out of the walls, and he was allowed to take samples of that. And the tests of that were inconclusive. They basically said it's oil based, but we're not sure what it is. And that was about all they could come up with about that. So, you know, I don't think Keith was really, he didn't seem super reluctant to let them. I mean, he let Steve and Don live in his house for essentially, I believe it was six days at first and then 8 days the second time, because they went back to two times. But, you know, and he kind of let them have the run of his house, and they recorded all around and everything like that. So, you know, had he been faking, he might not have done that, maybe. I kind of, you know, in the book, I sort of wanted to keep it. Like I said, it's mostly from Steve Mara's point of view, and he's just like, this is what I saw there and things like that. So I kind of wanted to keep it neutral. I said, well, I'll talk about what Keith reported before they got there. But, you know, I even said in the book, you know, this is from Steve Mara's point of view. He wasn't there. He didn't see these things. You know, we're just going by what Keith Linder said that he saw in his house prior to the investigators getting there.
All right, Jenny, talk to us about some of the phenomena surrounding poltergeist. When you're looking at these different cases, like the House of Fire, the Rockdale poltergeist, or the Mammoth Mountain poltergeist, are there common commonalities that you were able to find in each case? Because in the Linder case, of course, there were no children at all. No children that would have been kind of associated with it, which, as you know, a lot of times that's always assumed, that there's a preteen adolescent in the home that this seems to, you know, come around.
Yeah. And in that sense, the Keith Linder case was unusual because it had a lot of aspects of poltergeist activity. And then it also had a lot of aspects of like an intelligent or an interactive type haunting, especially with all the EVPs they got, which seemed to be commenting on what they were doing or answering their questions or what have you. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like in pretty much, probably about 80% of the cases that I researched, there was an adolescent or someone with that mindset of an adolescent, maybe, or someone that was a little bit older that was going through some kind of emotional, you know, they were going through a divorce or they had a death in the family, or, you know, there was some kind of conflict going on with them, or they had other kind of hardships in their life. You know, I was thinking of the case of, you know, Jackie Hernandez, the San Pedro case, where she was actually older than a poltergeist focus, but you know, all the things going on in her life. She had all kind of financial problems and kind of, you know, relationship problems and things like that that maybe manifested in that way. So it does seem like it's very rare for poltergeist activity to just pop up out of nowhere. There usually is some type of emotional conflict going on in the household where it takes place. Not always, but
has anybody asked the question, are the women that are present at that time, are they, or the men, because I know men go through their own version of it, but are any of the participants where there's not a younger adolescent involved, are any of them going through menopause or menopause?
Yeah, I don't know if that's ever been. Oh, wouldn't that be interesting? That never even occurred to me, actually.
Because I've thought about that on a few occasions, and some of the people I've spoken to that have had this happen, you know, I'll talk to some of these ladies at our events, and they're like, oh, man, I've been having hot flashes and going through menopause. It's brutal. And speaking of which, lately we've had all this activity, and I've started to wonder, I wonder if we are putting up some kind of chaotic energy, like a battery leaking. In adolescence, as we're kind of, you know, trying to work our way through this, if during menopause, when we're kind of going through this thing again, menopause for whoever's involved, if they might be working as a battery, kind of seeping energy again as well.
Yeah. And actually, and I'm glad you brought that up, because now I'm kind of going to look into that, because it really does seem like, I mean, there have been, a few papers written. There was one that came out that was in neuroquantology. I think it was in 2004. And it was two Italian parapsychologists. And they kind of had the idea that it was some kind of hormonally produced energy. And, you know, they focused on adolescence. But I don't see if it is hormonally produced, then I don't see why menopause or a similar type of thing might not be.
Right. And those are flashpoint moments, especially as for the older people that are experiencing it. You know, and it'd be interesting to see in those cases of not necessarily spontaneous human combustion, but there are cases of unexplained fires. And it would be interesting to see if those are taking place in places where people are dealing with that kinetic energy as well.
Oh, yeah. And another interesting thing, too, is that, you know, in this book, The Unseen Hand, I basically kind of categorize the cases by, you know, the main manifestation. I mean, it was hard to categorize some of them because, you know, the manifestations were kind of all over the place. But, you know, I kind of stuck with, you know, this is the main thing that happened. So I did a chapter on pyromaniac poltergeist. And it's interesting that almost every single one of those cases of spontaneous fires and stuff, it was almost always an adolescent girl. I think there was only one or two where it was an adolescent boy. But for some reason, there seemed to be this kind of overwhelming, you know, the way that the adolescent girl's anguish would come out was through fire. And I just thought that was so interesting, because that I think that chapter was the one that had the most similarity between the cases of what ended up causing it. And it was almost always a teenage girl.
Later on this year, both in August and September, we're going to be going to England with some of our listeners to go and explore all of these amazing locations and famous haunted sites and cemeteries, crypts, castles, jails, things like that. We're going to stop by where the former site of the Borley Rectory is. What do you know about the Borley Rectory and the spirit? And for anybody interested in going with us on that trip for August, we still have some slots available. Check out darknessevents.com. darknessevents.com. We've got a few slots still open if you'd like to join us. It is going to be the adventure of a lifetime. We love going overseas to do these trips and see all these places. Neil Story will be our host on this and is well versed in all of the great paranormal stories from that area. But what can you tell us about the Borley Rectory poltergeist?
Yeah, Borley Rectory. I actually did put that in my chapter on ghostly apparitions, since I mean, there was a lot of other things going on too. But I think the most famous manifestation was, you know, the phantom coach that people saw with the headless, you know, coachman or whatever. And there was also that case. To me, it seems like I'm kind of ambivalent about that case, because while it does seem that successive residents reported different types of manifestations, it seems like the early, you know, the first family that lived there shortly after the rectory was built, that seemed more like a straight up haunting. You know, they saw like a ghostly nun and they saw the phantom carriage and they saw things like that. And then it seemed like later on, you know, the family, Marianne Forster, I believe was her last name, where she would have, you know, the writing on the walls that was addressed to her, like asking for help and things like that. That seemed less like a haunting and more like poltergeist activity. Now, I believe there was some controversy later on with Marianne, you know, later saying that she had faked some of the phenomena or that the parapsychologists, the parapsychologist that was there studying it had maybe faked some of it. But, you know, she also accused her husband of faking some of it, too. So I'm not sure how stable she was exactly. But was it haunted? I don't know. If the manifestations, I believe the Society for Psychical Research kind of eventually came down on it not being haunted, that maybe, you know, the original stories about the ghosts and stuff were fabricated and that maybe later things were exaggerated or, you know, maybe the house had strange acoustics or something like that. So, you know, could it have been a poltergeist? Probably. If that's what it, if the reports were true, then it was probably a poltergeist. Although, you know, that would be unusual in the sense that several successive families had seen it, which would suggest that it was more like a haunting. But, you know, that's kind of one of those in-between gray area kind of cases where I don't think you can put it in one box or another.
The idea that there's this kind of chaotic energy, right, that surrounds places and people. And mm-hmm. I wonder if it is a mixture, right? Is it this is always there, and unless you add the nitro to it, it's never going to explode, right? Is it that it takes these two or three elements to come together to create the perfect storm? And once those elements change, whether it's barometric pressure, lining of the planets, you know, full moon, hormonal discharge, whatever, until those moments come. Because am I to understand this? Most poltergeist cases, true poltergeist cases, are flash in the pan. They're there for a couple weeks up to a couple months, and that's about the extent of it.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, other than a few, like the Enfield poltergeist, which was a year and a half, you know, there were some that kind of went on for a few months and then stopped and then started up again for a few more months. But in most cases, I don't think they lasted more than a few months. And it's almost like you said, and I don't think that we'll ever figure out, you know, all of the factors that have to go in, you know, to the mix to make it happen, because it does seem unusual. So it'll have to be some kind of unusual confluence of factors taking place that doesn't usually. So, you know, whether it's just kind of a channeling of energy that's already there, or whether it's energy coming from various places, you know, just into this one environment at this particular time, I'm not really sure. I think it might be that it's always around, and that maybe everyone has the potential, but that the other factors don't usually align at, you know, at the right time or the right place to make it take place. But, you know, I do think everyone probably has the potential for it to greater or lesser degrees.
All right. We need to take a break. We'll come back. We've got more with Jenny Ashford, her book, The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena. You can check out our website, JennyAshford.com. We'll have that up on our page, so you can check that out as well. We've got more coming your way as we explore poltergeist phenomena with our guest, Jenny Ashford, here on Beyond the Darkness.
This house is clean.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. Here is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave. That's Tim. Poltergeist, The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena. We're talking with our guest, Jenny Ashford. She's written three books on this type of phenomenon, these stories already. And we'll have a link up to her website. You can find that and follow along. You can also follow her on Facebook.com/ Jenny Ashford Author and at Twitter @ Jenny Ashford. All right, Jenny, you know, one of the fascinating aspects of your book, in the last chapter, you really kind of talk about demonic possession and the possibility that that might be poltergeist activity. How do you connect those two?
I kind of feel like, and I'm sort of approaching, like I said, I'm sort of approaching poltergeist activity more from, you know, a strange science, like a fringe science point of view, rather than saying that it's kind of an outside entity. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I almost wanted to use like a lot of these demonic possession cases, or what people usually think of as demonic possession cases, and maybe make the argument that these could be poltergeist manifestations, just sort of coming out in a way that, you know, that maybe that's what the focus or the witnesses around the focus expect it to come out like. Because particularly these types of manifestations usually only occur in very religious families. And I'm kind of making the argument that within this framework, you know, when they see these particular things taking place, they will immediately associate it with a demon, which may in fact actually encourage the, you know, the energy that's causing the poltergeist manifestation to make it act like a demon. Because like I said, I do feel like there's some element of self-fulfilling prophecy going on with these sort of manifestations. And, you know, some of the cases that I talk about in this chapter, I think were largely might have been mental illness, as in the case of Annalise McCall, who, you know, she was the subject of the famous movie, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, that was based on her story. Mm-hmm. I think in her case, it was probably largely mental illness. But there were some other cases, like the case of Roland Doe, who the movie The Exorcist was loosely based on, where there was some poltergeist type phenomena that took place that was witnessed by other people, like object movement and things like that. So I definitely think his case was a case of a poltergeist outbreak that was interpreted as demonic possession and treated as such.
All right. You know, when you hear about poltergeist, or, you know, maybe things happening around them, but how does that affect them, that there's suddenly weird voices? I guess the levitation could be considered part of poltergeist activity, right? The knockings, the bangings, a lot of that, which does seem like it. But do you think that that kind of activity is creating a neural breakdown, which is making the person believe that they have an invading entity in their head or in their body?
I'm not really sure. I think that's probably possible, that's what's taking place. In a lot of ways, I'm not sure if the focus, since usually the focus is a child, I'm not sure how aware they are of how things are coming out. I mean, it does seem like in some cases, you know, they started out kind of doing it like as a prank, or, you know, just acting out, like, you know, because they had some kind of mental problems or emotional problems. But I don't know, like, I don't know if they're necessarily doing it on purpose. So it could very well be something going on within their brains that's sort of causing these things to happen. So, you know, it's giving them the belief that they're demonically possessed, which actually may, I think it actually may encourage more and larger manifestations to take place, because I think there's some aspect of poltergeist phenomena that I kind of, there was kind of a thread that was running through a lot of the cases, that, you know, it would start small and then build up and build up and build up. And I think that happens because the focus begins to believe that it can do all these things. Like, at first it's just the knocking, and it's like, oh, I wonder what that is. And then you kind of get afraid of that, and it's almost like it feeds back on itself, so it can do larger and larger things. And I think that's kind of why, you know, why poltergeist phenomena tends to start very small and then kind of, you know, get up to these much larger manifestations, like much larger, you know, pieces of furniture moving and fire starting and things like that. So I definitely do think that there's a relationship between the belief of the focus that an outside entity is attacking them, or that an outside entity is doing it like a demon, and you know, the way that the poltergeist manifests itself. I definitely do think, I don't think that you can do it if you know that it's you doing it. You know what I mean? And some of the other poltergeist focuses that I've talked to said the same thing. They said, well, you know, and particularly in the case of the Mammoth Mountain poltergeist, that's actually what stopped the manifestation, was the focus realizing that the manifestations were coming from him. So I definitely think that there has to be some kind of perception that it's an outside force doing it. It's almost like you can't consciously do it.
Let's talk about the science of it, right? Neuroscience, quantum mechanics. People love to throw those terms around. But is there any real data to back up the idea that this phenomena is taking place and we do have some kind of scientific understanding of how it may be happening or why it may be happening?
I do feel like, I mean, they don't really do a great deal of studies anymore of, you know, psychokinetic powers, you know, in a laboratory kind of setting. And it seems like even back in the days when they did do them, you know, the results were pretty inconclusive, or, you know, sometimes they caught the people faking with thread and things like that. But I think that probably if this is a genuine phenomena, which I think it is, I mean, because it's been reported all over the world for thousands of years, and it, you know, and the manifestations are pretty standard across cultures. So I definitely think there's something there that needs to be described. But I definitely think that it's going to be something that is hormonally based, or that is based in a sort of, you know, there's kind of a theory going around, the ORC OR theory, which I'm not sure if you've heard about that, but it's Dr. Stuart Hameroff, who's an anesthesiologist, and Sir Roger Penrose, who is a physicist. And they're kind of wondering if they kind of posit these little structures called microtubules that are inside your brain, and almost that these act on a quantum level. And if this is correct, they said, in theory, then your thoughts are not really contained inside your brain. It's almost like, so they could, in theory, act on the outside environment, which could also open up the possibility of your personality surviving beyond death and things of that nature. They're basically saying your personhood, your soul, for lack of a better term, is not constrained within the physical, you know, thing of your brain. And that, so in some circumstances, it could act outside of your physical body. They have had some, that's kind of still on the fringe, but they have had a few, you know, little things come up that say, you know, maybe that's on the right track. And I kind of do feel like that's the direction, if they do eventually discover something in this line, I think that's where it's going to come from. This kind of, some kind of interaction between some structure in the brain and the outside, you know, operating as some sort of quantum mechanical, you know, almost like spooky action at a distance, you know, that type of thing. I think that's kind of where the future of this type of thing lies.
Is there danger where these cases are concerned with real poltergeist activity? I mean, have we had legitimate cases of severe injury or possibly even death in these cases? I know Annalise Michel, that was kind of an extreme version, right? But that was more of the demonic possession aspect. But aside from, you know, a pot flying across the room or something like that, are people really being hurt in these poltergeist situations?
You know, it's unusual, but it does happen. It did happen, I believe, in the Stockport poltergeist case, I want to say, where a girl was pushed down the stairs by an unseen force and her ankle was broken. There was also a case in the 60s in Brazil of a little girl who was plagued by what seemed to be a poltergeist. Her family believed it was demonic, and the poor girl got sent around to different shamans and different priests and things like that, trying to rid her of this entity over, I believe it was 4 to 6 years. And eventually she did end up dying. Now, they're not sure if it was a suicide or if, you know, she died because she had a soda and there had been poison put in it. So they're not sure if she poisoned herself or if somehow this entity, because this entity seemed like it had been trying to kill her for quite a while. It would, you know, it would repeatedly hit her and throw her around. And so I'm not real sure if, you know, if there's some way that the entity could have done something to her drink without her knowing about it, or if she just killed herself because she couldn't take it anymore. But that's one of the few cases where the focus did actually die. And like you said, Annalise Michel also ended up dying from her apparent possession as well. But it's unusual. And the strange thing, too, and this is reported in a lot of cases, that even when people are hit by flying objects, and this happens a lot, particularly in cases where there's rains of stones and things like that, people will be hit by the stones, but they don't feel them. Like the stones fall more slowly than gravity would suggest, or, you know, they seem like they're going very fast, but when they hit, it's very soft, things like that. So it's almost like whatever this is, and like I said, since I'm kind of operating under the assumption that these manifestations are caused by a living person's energy doing this, maybe in some unconscious way, the person generating the poltergeist doesn't really want to hurt anyone. So maybe that's kind of where, and, you know, because like I said, the cases where people really get hurt or people get killed are very, very rare. And so maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's just some kind of case of maybe deep down they do know that they're generating this and they don't want to hurt anyone. They don't want to hurt themselves. You know, like I said, not to say, but it seems like most of the time if people are hurt, it's pretty minor. It's usually, you know, maybe being slapped or scratched or things like that. But it doesn't seem like anything really, really major other than, you know, just a handful of cases.
All right. We know that in some, you know, when you talk about exorcism through the use of theological evocation, religious ceremonies, that you can be successful in removing these. In ghost cases, there is energy changing, feng shui, saging, smudging, prayer that seem to get rid of it. How about in the case of poltergeist? Is there any known way to dampen the effects and keep it from being so troublesome?
Basically, the only thing that seems to work most of the time, like I said, since there seems to be a relationship between the manifestations and between the expectations and the beliefs of the focus and the witnesses and the environment, sometimes an exorcism will do the trick if the focus believes that it will. But what seems to work a lot of times, and what a lot of parapsychologists, and actually Steve Merrow told me about this, that what a lot of parapsychologists will do now, where there is a place where there's been a lot of poltergeist activity, you know, if it's so bad that they have to remove the family from the house, which they do have to do, they had to do in the Rochdale poltergeist case, they eventually removed the family. But what they will do is they will try to keep that building empty. They will turn off the electricity. They will not allow anyone to go inside. Basically, they are wanting to starve it of any kind of energy, whether it's from, you know, the electrical outlets or whether it's from people. And, you know, his phrase for it is fallowing the property is what they do. They'll leave it for, I think in the case of the Rochdale poltergeist, they left it for almost a year. 11 months, I believe they left it. They locked it up. They left it empty. They didn't want anyone to go in there. And they turned off the power, the main power supply and everything like that. And that seems to have done it because they've done subsequent checkups of the house, like when other tenants moved in, you know, to see if there's any unusual activity continuing there. And there was not. So in a lot of cases, I think that seems to work. And that kind of just backs up the whole theory that this is maybe some kind of, you know, not an unintelligent energy, but one that, you know, the one that doesn't really have any intention other than the unconscious intentions of the focus. But I do think it's definitely caused by some kind of energy in the environment.
I've wondered if, you know, I mean, there's and we've talked, Tim, on the show in the past about the idea of degaussing a location that's known to be haunted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how do you explain what a degaussing mechanism is? What does it do?
Well, a degausser will take the magnetic energy and basically get rid of it. So if you're degaussing a magnetic tape, you would take and get rid of the magnetic
image on it, right?
Yeah, image off the tape, right.
Right.
So you're getting rid of it.
And back in the old days, you used to use these degaussing machines to put on your TV when you'd start to get the rainbow effect on your TV.
Right, yeah.
It was a buildup of magnetic effect.
Right.
So they'd come in and they'd disrupt that pattern and it would flush it and allow the TV to work again. And if most of these hauntings do work in an electromagnetic field, could we go in and disperse that energy by degaussing it, by erasing that magnetic memory of a location? And I often wonder if people could be magnetically resonated that way as well. Can we disrupt their magnetic pattern to either stop the causal effect of a poltergeist activity or degauss their surroundings so that if this person is still putting off the PK, they're not feeding into what is already an existing issue on that site? Has there been any work like that, Jenny, looked into of disrupting the pattern of the person or the location, the element itself of magnetizing?
Yeah, that I have not heard of. You know, like I said, it seemed like most of the things they try to do are just try to just starve the phenomenon of any kind of electromagnetic energy, you know, electricity or people being in the environment. But that is actually an intriguing avenue. And I would have to research that more to see if anyone is doing that specific thing of like trying to specifically, you're talking about specifically demagnetizing or
a person and the location or one or the other. Right.
I mean, I don't see any reason why that wouldn't work because, you know, like I said, I do think that there's definitely some kind of electromagnetic aspect to all of this.
Now, so be careful, folks. We're just theorizing. I'm not a scientist. Yeah. I just like to pretend I'm smart. But if I don't know how that would affect the brain chemistry of a person either if they're subjecting themselves to a degaussing machine. So please do not do it unless you've spoken to somebody who has a full understanding and idea on how that would work so that you don't end up hurting yourself or affecting your heart, your brain, any of the more important parts of you. that's where it gets crazy, right? I mean, a lot of this is just theory and conjecture. We look at the reasons, we try to make sense of them and understand it. Let's talk about a couple of the creepier cases that you cover in the book as well.
Okay. I kind of feel like most of the creepiest cases I found were probably, you know, the more violent type of cases, you know, like the South Shields poltergeist and things like that, which, you know, because once it gets to the point where it's actually hurting people, you know, you don't really know what else it could do, you know.
What happened on that case?
Well, in the South Shields poltergeist, actually the names of the couple at the center of it were never revealed to the public. They were going under a pseudonym because they didn't want any negative publicity, but they were called Mark and Marianne. And they had a 3-year-old son. This happened in 2005 and in England. And basically what ended up happening, the first thing that ended up happening was the couple, Mark and Marianne, started to get assaulted by their kids' toys. You know, stuffed animals would come flying in from everywhere and just start, you know, hitting them and, you know, their covers got yanked off and things like that.
Okay.
And then, it kind of got to a point where it started getting a lot more violent. I mean, they would find some of their kids' stuffed toys with knives in its paws. Like he had a stuffed rabbit and they found it at the top of the stairs.
Yikes.
With a knife in its paws. And then they started getting written messages on, their son had a little whiteboard in his room and there would be messages written on like die and things like that. On a couple of occasions, the kid was even found swaddled, like he was wrapped up really tight, like in his blankets. And one time they found him crammed in a closet, like under the stairs. And then one time they found him like hanging in a tree or like up in a tree or something. And they couldn't figure out how he had gotten up there. And it's just all these crazy, you know, kind of things, like the kid felt like something was burning him. And there was just all these, you know, or the father felt like something was burning him. And there were like all these angry red marks on his back and things like that. And then even the wife, Marianne, she started getting text messages with like death threats and things like that. And it was investigated and they couldn't figure out where the messages were coming from. and things like that. And it was just this crazy violent. And, you know, there were no adolescents in this environment. I mean, it didn't seem like there was any kind of emotional conflict going on. You know, it was just them and their 3-year-old kid. And all of a sudden, these crazy things started happening. And, you know, as far as I know, it went on probably about 6 months, maybe. And, you know, then ended up kind of, there were other things going on too, objects flying around, and they heard funny voices and, you know, stuff coming out of the baby monitor and stuff like that. But, you know, and I think that actually when paranormal investigators came, they actually did see like a shadowed figure sort of hanging around in the little boy's room and things like that. So, but this went on for 6-7 months, and then it just kind of petered out all of a sudden, and they never really figured out what had caused it or why it suddenly started, you know, why it suddenly decided to target them. But that was that was one of the crazier cases that I wrote about in there, with all the for some reason this bit with the knife in its paws like freaked me out the most. I don't know why that was, because I thought if I was walking through my house and I actually saw that, I think I would probably
this sounds like a Guillermo del Toro version of Toy Story.
It definitely does. Yeah. It definitely does.
Oh, chilling stuff. Yeah, that's the time I either get rid of my kids or their toys or both. That's the only safe route to go. Oh, Chucky gets lucky and the bunny's there to kill everybody. That's nice. All right, what's another one of your favorite stories?
Let's see. I think probably another
one. And Jenny, I need to ask you, if you had somebody call you and they said, Jenny, I've got this case going on right now, all this activity, toys are attacking, a bunny with a knife in its paw, we need you to come in and spend a few nights here, would you sign up, or would you say, no, just report to me afterwards, and I'll make sure to share the story with listeners across the world?
Do you know what? I would definitely go. Because I'm enough of a skeptic, and and probably a lot of people that are, you know, really hardcore like paranormal believers would probably say that I'm stupid enough to kind of go into these environments, because I want to experience it. Like I said, I've only experienced very minor poltergeist activity, which actually didn't frighten me. Mm-hmm. You know, but actually when it happened, I was kind of like, oh, well, there it is. I've been wanting to see it and there it is. So it didn't scare me and it didn't bother me. But, you know, if someone that I knew was not prone to making things up, and they called me and they said, okay, all this stuff is going on at my house, you will not believe this, you have to come here and see this, I would definitely go. I would definitely go.
All right.
But, you know, if it got too scary, I'm running out of there. I'm not proud. I'm not too proud to say that, but I definitely would.
If you got it going on, check facebook.com/JennyAshfordAuthor and let her know that it's time for her to come spend the night at your place. Let's talk about another one or two of your favorite stories before we wrap up for the evening that you cover in the book.
Okay. Oh, here was another one that really that freaked me out. I have a section in the book that's called Water, Oil, and Blood, and it's kind of about, you know, quote unquote poltergeist flows, you know, where you get oil coming out of the walls and things like that. But one of my favorite cases, just because it was so weird and so random, was the Atlanta Blood House. And that was so odd because there really didn't seem to be any reason behind it. It was just an elderly couple. They were like in their 70s. This took place in 1987. And they had lived in this house for, you know, 20 years, something like that. Nothing weird had ever happened there. All of a sudden, the elderly lady, her name was Minnie, and she got out of the shower one night and there was a big puddle of blood on the floor. And the first thing she thought was, you know, that her husband, William, was hurt because, you know, he wasn't in the greatest of health and things like that. So she calls out to him. She's like, what happened? What happened? And he comes in and he's fine and he's just got clean pajamas on. There's no blood anywhere. And all this other stuff. And she's like, there's a big puddle of blood on the floor. And so they start searching the house and there's just puddles of blood everywhere. It's just on the walls. It's like underneath the refrigerator. Ooh. It's just all over the place. And they can't figure out. So they called the cops. I mean, because they didn't know what else to do. And, you know, the cops came and they were like, well, you know, is this from, you know, the husband, William, is this from his dialysis? And he's like, well, I don't do dialysis here. I go to the clinic and do it. And he's like, you know, I'm fine. I'm not caught or anything. And then the cops thought that, oh, well, maybe an animal got in the house that was bleeding and got blood everywhere, but they couldn't find an animal. And then when they tested the blood, it was human blood. And the weird thing was that it was a blood type that neither William nor Minnie were. It was a different blood type to them. And I mean, this just went, it only happened a couple of times. And the cops actually closed off the house because they thought at first they, well, maybe it's a crime scene, you know, so right. we don't want anybody like tramping through there and messing up all the evidence. But, you know, once they had the blood tested and they searched the whole house and they couldn't figure out where it came from. And, you know, that's just the weird randomness of this whole thing. And it was kind of a big deal. It was called the Atlanta Bloodhouse. You know, it was in all the papers and everything like that. But, you know, it only happened a few times and then it really just never happened again. It was just all of a sudden kind of, hey, there's blood all over the house for no reason. And as far as I know, the house is still there. It's on Fountain Drive in Atlanta. So I don't know if other people live there now, but I haven't heard, you know, I did a little research into the address, but I haven't heard anybody else complaining of any blood turning up inexplicably in their house since then. So hopefully it's gone now.
Yeah. Wow. That's the kind of stuff. See, that's where I want to send Tim to investigate while I'm safely at home, watching Doctor Who reruns. I think it's best that way. But Tim, you should definitely go check out cases like that where there's blood seeping from the walls. You know, you brought up the rocks manifestation. That's pretty popular with poltergeist activity and Bigfoot activity, right? Here you've got this unseen force in the woods where rocks are being launched at you, which is very much like poltergeist activity. And I often wonder if there might be some correlation with this.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that there's Bigfoot in your house dropping pebbles on you, but you know, where are these rocks coming from that are manifesting? And I know there's been change, pennies, dimes, nickels from heaven that just seem to fall into areas, and it's water as well. These like inside manifestations of rain coming down walls or from the ceilings. What do you make of that? I mean, trying to understand and be skeptical is one thing, but that seems to be just beyond reproach. I mean, how do you explain that away?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I really don't feel like, and especially this is why I was so fascinated by the Rochdale poltergeist case, mm-hmm. which I wrote an entire book about with Steve Mara. The fact that this rain was coming out of the ceiling and everyone could see it. They were just, I mean, all the paranormal investigators, he was there, five of his investigators were there. The whole family was there. It's like, you know, we were all just standing there watching. And we just saw this rain just coming out of the ceiling. And he's like, and at one point we even saw water like moving across the ceiling, like intelligently, and it moved around a light fixture, like it was trying to avoid it. And the weird thing about that was that they actually took a sample of that water that had moved across the ceiling and tested it against a control sample that they took from the bathroom tap in the house. And the bathroom tap water was normal. The water from the ceiling had a huge electrical charge, like off the charts. They, you know, the lab that analyzed it said we rarely see electrical charge this high in water. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of it if it's going through copper pipes and things like that, but this was like 10 times more than what they would normally see. So, you know, it's just, and the thing about the stones too, I think in a lot of cases, the stones either seem like they're coming out of the sky, or in a few cases, people see them manifesting right above the ceiling and then falling to the floor. You know, obviously that's a lot harder to fake. I mean,
right.
You know, stones coming down from outside, that could conceivably be somebody throwing it, you know, or something like that. But stones coming down in your house and not making a hole in the ceiling, just appearing, you know, up near the ceiling and falling to the floor. I mean, obviously that's pretty hard to fake, but that was a pretty common manifestation. Not as much as it used to be, weirdly. I found that a lot of the stone throwing, and actually the first section in the book is stone throwers, and a lot of those cases were older. It almost seems like that isn't as popular a manifestation anymore. I'm not really sure why that is. I did find that.
Stone throwing is so 1800s. Don't you know that,
yeah,
Jenny?
I know. I just thought that was very weird that I was like, that doesn't really seem to be reported much anymore, because it used to be one of the most commonly reported aspects. Yeah.
Jenny Ashford, our guest. Check out the book, The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena. We'll have links up to Jenny's website and how you can find her on Facebook as well. Tomorrow we're back. Jimmy Church is our guest, the host of Fade to Black and one of the fill-in hosts of Coast to Coast AM. We're going to talk about conspiracy theories, some of the most outlandish, dumb, and amazing conspiracies. Why do people look for these nefarious schemes behind events? We'll talk about that with Jimmy Church tomorrow on the show. Hey, guys, if you want a chance to meet me and some really cool experiences, I'm going to be at Wizard World Minneapolis the first weekend here in May. Tim's going to join me on Friday night. We're going to be doing a superhero movies panel along with some other locals, and we'll be doing that on Friday night. I'll also be doing a paranormal talk on Friday night. I'd love for you to join me for that. Saturday, I'll be hosting the Doctor Who Hooniverse fan panel. We'll be talking about classic and new Who, monsters and spinoffs and regenerations and all the cool stuff. We've got a great panel building up for that as well. And then Sunday, Tim, I'm pretty psyched about this. I am a nerd of many colors, Tim. Not only am I into the paranormal and sci-fi with Doctor Who, but I'll be hosting the Monkees panel with Mickey Dolenz and Peter Tork live on hand. We'll go through a Q&A panel and throw it open to fans of the Monkees on the floor to ask questions of the guys as well. How do you like that?
You're pretty mundane for that announcement. I mean, you're pretty low-key about
this
whole deal.
Dude, I'm so psyched. It's insane. Yeah. This is so cool. Wizard, man, you and I grew up going to Comic-Cons. Yeah. Now we're going to be talking at Comic-Cons.
I know.
So I'm pretty psyched about this and to get to sit down with two of my musical favorites, Mickey Dolenz and Peter Tork from the Monkees. You can find information by going to darknessevents.com. You'll find all the places that you can visit Tim and I throughout the year by visiting darknessevents.com. Don't forget True Crime Tuesday. It's back. We've got it available through our Patreon page now. And our guest last night was JT Townsend. We talked about the Cincinnati Psycho, a strangler loose in 1966 Cincinnati. A compelling and creepy story. Plus, we had some great dumb crime, stupid criminals. For more information on how you can listen to True Crime Tuesday, go check out darknessradio.com. Click on the True Crime Tuesday banner, and you'll find all the information there on how you can subscribe as well and be a part of that world with us. Also want to mention I'm going to be hosting Coast to Coast AM this Saturday, midnight till 4 a.m., and it's going to be a great show. You can find stations and times in your area by visiting coasttocoastam.com/stations. And check out the best in overnight talk radio, George Norrie, on Coast to Coast AM tonight. The first half, Jonathan Wells, PhD, argues that empirical science is devolving into zombie science. Shuffling along unfazed by opposing evidence, discredited icons of evolution rise from the dead, while more icons equally bogus join their ranks like a B-horror movie. They just keep coming. And in the second half, Patty Greer researches and has visited more than 100 crop circles. She's going to share the latest in crop formation research, which she believes demonstrates that crop circles are rising from the earth in counter-rotating plasma vortices, which knock down the plants in spectacular patterns. That's tonight with George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM. Let's thank our sponsors for the evening, Tim.
Yeah.
Big word, sponsors. I was having a hard time with that. When you're in the market and you're looking for a brand new bed and you want solid nights of sleep, then take me up on this. We've got a 100-night trial and full refund if you're not completely satisfied with the Casper beds. So go check out CasperTrial.com/darkness and then use the code 50SLEEP to save $50 off of any of the beds that they have there. And you will definitely thank us. Both Tim and I are converted believers. We love this bed. You will too. Go check out CasperTrial.com/darkness. And also, special thanks to True Car. When you're in the market to get a new or a previously owned vehicle and you want the trust of making the right decisions, there's over 13,000 certified True Car dealers across the nation. They've got over 3 million cars sold. You can make the call and do it yourself. Try True Car. That's T-R-U-E-C-A-R. And I promise you're going to absolutely love that. We'll be back again tomorrow with Jimmy Church here on Beyond the Darkness.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.